Robin Hood Radio and the Robin Hood Radio Network is proud to present Leonard Lopate at Large, lively hour-long in-depth discussions providing overviews and context to topics usually covered in partial measures. His guests include leading thinkers, scientists, artists, economists, farmers, historians, authors, and politicians. Mr. Lopate is a Peabody Award winner whose numerous honors include 3 Associated Press Awards and 3 James Beard Awards.
Welcome to Leonard Lopate at Large. I'm Leonard Lopate. When its Upper West Side landlord forced the Lincoln Plaza Cinema to close a year ago, a group of local residents teamed up with other concerned moviegoers to create Coalition for New Plaza Cinema, a nonprofit that raises money to keep independent foreign and documentary films on movie screens in their neighborhood. New Plaza is celebrating its first anniversary at 6:30 tonight with a tribute to Lincoln Plaza founder Dan Talbert and Bernardo Bertolucci at the New York Institute of Technology at 1871 Broadway. It will begin with a screening of Bertolucci's 1970 film, The Conformist, followed by an interview by Philip Lopate of Dan Talbert's widow and partner, Toby Talbert. Toby Talbert joins us now, along with attorney Norma Levy, the founder of the Coalition for a New Plaza Cinema, and veteran film distributor Gary Palmucci. Welcome to our show.
Thank you.
It's great to be here.
Toby, how long were you and your husband, the late Dan Talbert, in the film business?
Well, if you start with our courtship, mm-hmm. quite a while. We were married in the 50s, and we courted each other. Well, I don't want to pun, but we did court each other in the dark. So we were going to a lot of movies when we were very young, and we officially entered the field when we opened the New Yorker Theater on Broadway between 88th and 89th Street
in 1960.
Yes.
And you wrote in your memoir, The New Yorker Theater and Other Scenes from a Life at the Movies, that you thought it would go on forever.
Well, maybe. Dan and I very seldom disagreed on most things, especially movies. Maybe I thought it would go on forever, but Dan, at a certain point in 1974, decided that he was going to get involved more deeply in distribution, and that he already had figured out what he had done successfully at the New Yorker, and being very venturous and very venturesome, he decided to sell the New Yorker Theater and devote himself totally to distribution. And Bernardo Bertolucci's film, Before the Revolution, was the presenting symptom for that. It was the first film we distributed.
And you distributed it because you wanted to show it, and the people in Europe said, no, we won't just allow one movie theater to show it? Force you into the distribution business?
Well, the producer said in order for a film to play, we didn't even know the jargon of the trade, you had to have a distributor. So Dan, innocently, as if he'd just dropped from the cloud, said, well, what is a distributor? And we were told what a distributor is, and Dan said, well, we'll distribute it.
Now, Gary Palmucci, you're a film distributor. The same rules apply today?
Well, I would say that there's some films where the filmmakers or the producers are so eager to have them screened in America that they will negotiate directly with certain theaters in New York, like the Film Forum or the Film Society of Lincoln Center, if a distribution deal is not forthcoming. But their preference, of course, is to have a national distribution deal for the film.
Now, Toby, there already was a great theater showing foreign films and art films in the Upper West Side. There were theaters around the city that also showed them. The Thalia was a place that a lot of people went to. What did you see as your mission? What were you going to show that the Thalia didn't show?
Well,
or is it the Thalia?
Course,
I never remember.
Well, we obviously, Dan and I went to the Thalia as we did to the Beverly. We went to some of those cinemas. But the Thalia was a kind of revolving belt, a repertory house that continued to show the same films regularly, which was a blessing for those who had missed it. But the New Yorker Theater started out showing films of the 30s and the 40s, American films that hadn't been around. And that's how we started. And then we began showing first-run films. A first-run film means that you are the one who launches it.
So you were showing American classics at a time when most film buffs thought European movies were great and American movies were for the general public.
Yes, it was.
You were saying there's art from Hollywood as well.
It was the Europeans who told us that American movies were art movies.
The British Film Institute and the Cinémathèque Française were started in the mid-30s.
Exactly.
And they were showing American movies as art all along.
Exactly. So we needed Langlois in Paris, Le Cahier du Cinéma, to tell us these American movies are art movies.
But how much is of the story of your theaters has to do with real estate? The West Side art houses tied to the value of real estate. I mean, the value closed in 1987. The Symphony Space became something else. The New Yorker closed. You then went to other theaters, opened up other theaters, and they. And then moved on again and again. Was it all because of real estate?
I think there's an interesting ecology here that I'd like to point out. For example, when we ran the New Yorker Theater, the Upper West Side was a place where children who lived on the East Side weren't permitted to go.
Yeah, it was kind of
rundown
area.
The side streets were druggy. There were hookers around. It was not what they call a nice neighborhood. And then when we opened the cinema studio, the only lights there were Lincoln Center. Around it was a ghost town, aside from a little dinky coffee shop next door where Balanchine would have his barley soup and a funeral parlor where presumably Rudolph Valentino had laid in state. It was really a very dead area. So often these cinemas can create a kind of liveliness around them.
You also had sponsored a bookstore, New Yorker Books, around the corner from the New Yorker Theater. Aren't bookstores also something of an endangered species these days?
Well, it seems that way. Our bookstore, the New Yorker Bookstore, was upstairs above the theater with Pete Martin, who had started City Lights with Ferlinghetti. But I see now that a big empty space on Broadway is now opening up as a bookstore. So we don't know how people long for bookstores. We don't know whether they can afford to keep open.
Norma, were you living in the Upper West Side at the time we're talking about?
I had moved to New York for the first time in 1965 after college. So I wasn't there in the 50s, certainly. But
you could have gone to the New Yorker successors.
I did to a certain extent, although I primarily started going to art films or foreign films after I graduated from law school, met my husband, and he introduced me to a world that really I didn't know.
In the case of the New Yorker, sometimes it was a time of double features, and some of the pairings were kind of stunning, like the Magnificent Ambersons and Pull My Daisy on the same bill. Even now, it seems like a rather daring idea.
Daring, but I envy anyone who had the opportunity to see the juxtaposition of those two films. And I think that the element of surprise was also something. People knew if they came to the New Yorker, they'd have an experience. And people who came to the Lincoln Plaza sometimes weren't even looking at what was playing. They just came in with confidence that they would see something of value.
So after you left the New Yorker, you closed it down, then you decided to open up another theater.
Well, then we devoted ourselves for a few years to distribution, New Yorker films. And I must say that Dan introduced some of the most prominent filmmakers that we know today, Fassbinder, Herzog, Godard. You know, he nurtured these early talents, and he created a cinema community, a cultural community.
Now, Gary, we're talking about some of the greatest filmmakers of our time.
Absolutely.
And why would they have had a hard time finding distribution in this country?
Well,
Would that still be the case today? Are there some filmmakers that I should know about who are falling through the cracks?
I don't know about falling through the cracks, but I think there are some filmmakers who are always going to be somewhat challenged in their ability to find a significant enough audience to interest a commercial distributor. And I think someone like Fassbinder, his early films had played at the Museum of Modern Art in selections of New German Cinema, but they hadn't had any real commercial exposure until Dan in the mid-70s bought Toby, I believe, about a dozen of his pictures in one fell swoop, right, and put them into release.
Yes, he did.
And I think that Godard has had kind of an up-and-down career in commercial distribution in America. Now he's been on the upswing. His last two or three films have had very successful distribution here.
Well, Breathless was made in 1960, the same time that The New Yorker opened.
That's right.
But I remember as when I was in college in the 50s, most of the people I knew were interested in seeing good films. The 400 Blows, everybody talked about that film. They all went to see the Satyajit Ray films. But you weren't showing those kinds of movies?
Well, we were showing. How can I make the difference? We were showing
because you were filling a void, and I want to know what the void was.
Well, we didn't think of ourselves as filling a void. We thought of ourselves as playing movies that we found exciting and challenging, and you know, eventually we were able to develop an audience who felt the same way.
And you did all sorts of interesting things. You premiered Shoah and created a huge sensation.
Yes. Well, when we went over one late on a 7 o'clock flight on a Friday, overwhelmed by it. It was without titles, and Claude Lanzmann whispering what was going on. And Fassbinder, it's a far comparison, but to his American presence became important in Germany. Shoah, due to what Dan did for that film here, became significant in Europe.
Ah, so finally it was going in the other direction.
Yes.
Most of the, at that time, films would open in New York. And Gary, this has been talked about a lot. A film would open in New York, and if it was a success, got good reviews, then the art house in Kansas City or somewhere else in the country would then feel that it was safe to open it.
Absolutely. The New York gross, the New York reviews were always and still are a barometer for the extent to which a successful art film is going to play around the country.
Of course, that can be a problem because some pretty great films have gotten some pretty bad reviews over the years.
But most of them have recovered, I think, over time.
Yes, I did want to say that the Lincoln Plaza Cinema became a kind of first reader. If a distributor managed to have us play a film at the Lincoln Plaza Cinema, art houses around the country, often without even looking at the film, would book it. Mm-hmm. They would have the assurance that it was something of value.
And in 1981, you wound up opening the Lincoln Plaza. Did you think at that time that it would go on forever?
Well, we had a lease, and the lease was renewed. We never thought in those terms of forever at that point.
The Milstein property says that vital structural work was needed and a repair to waterproof the plaza around the building.
Well, I don't know what improvements he had in mind. It seemed to me that they were largely external, but, you know, he has his reasons. As Jean Renoir said in one of his films, everyone has his reasons.
I'm speaking with Toby Talbot, with Norma Levy and Gary Palmucci about movies in New York City, movie theaters in New York City. This is Leonard Lopate at Large, WBAI, New York, 99.5 FM. Norma, you told the New York Times that you and your husband regularly saw movies at the Lincoln Plaza Cinema for decades. Had you ever gone to the movies at some of the other Talbot theaters, like the New Yorker?
I'm sure I have, yes. But the one that I remember, the one that's outstanding in my memory, is Lincoln Plaza.
And you've said that you remember the moment somebody told you that the Lincoln Plaza was closing, that it was, quote, like the day that you first heard that Kennedy had been shot.
Well, I guess perhaps is that an exaggeration? Perhaps.
I don't know. You're the one who said it.
But it was a stunning moment for so many of us who had been going to that theater for years and years and years, and it was something special in our lives. And we see it all the time as people come to our theater, the new Plaza Cinema now, and they talk about how much they miss Lincoln Plaza, how important it was in their lives. And how they're so happy that we're trying to recreate a theater in the Upper West Side like that. It's just it was a phenomenon that meant a lot to a very large community of people.
So you set about trying to create a community organization?
That's correct.
How does one do that? I mean, do you hand out leaflets to people on the street?
Excuse me, I'm going to barge in a minute. Norma is very modest, but at Dan's tribute, when he passed on, the tribute filled 5 auditoriums of people who were mourning the demise of the theater, and Norma was already out in front of the theater passing out flyers with this inspiration that she had.
It just seemed that it had to continue, that there was no reason why it shouldn't continue. It was filled with people. We loved it. And all the other theaters had gradually left the Upper West Side, or so many of them that we used to go to.
Well, there still are some pretty important theaters showing independent foreign and documentary films, the Walter Reed, the Eleanor Boonin Monroe Film Center, the Film Society of Lincoln Center, but they were not necessarily showing the kinds of movies that you would get at the Lincoln Plaza.
There was something very special about Lincoln Plaza. It had 6 screens. It had a continued variation of films that would go in and out. It was like a refuge from the world. You go there and you felt very comfortable while you were there. It was a very homey environment. I know of no other theater which serves lox sandwiches. there was something just very unique and friendly about it. And when I told my physician, my internist, that I'd gotten involved in this project and I never got any sleep anymore, he said that he's been astonished at the number of people who have come to him and complained about the loss in that they felt in their lives of not having this theater around. It's hard to describe what it meant to so many people, but its loss is tremendous, and we would like to remedy that.
It seemed almost like an anchor in that community. And when you walk down Broadway, you just couldn't miss the marquee and see all the films that were being shown there. So is this also about keeping a sense of community alive?
Perhaps. And you know, I think there was that sense of community when you would go to Lincoln Plaza. That was one of the joys of it. People talk about all the conversations overheard in the restrooms about the film that they just saw, and you know, you talk to your neighbors in the seats. It was a place where you felt you belonged in a world where you do need anchors.
Gary, where I grew up in Williamsburg, Brooklyn, when I was a kid, I think there were 6 or 7 theaters, all within a 5-block radius, and now there are none there, and it feels like a desert. How important are movie theaters for sustaining a sense of community?
I think they're crucial, they're vital, and I think we've seen this. I've seen it around the city in the last several years with the success of some of these new theaters around the city, like Metrograph on Ludlow Street in Lower Manhattan, the Nighthawk in Williamsburg, and now on Prospect Park West. the revived Quad down on West 13th Street in the Village, and I think the kind of instant success and, you know, young, enthusiastic young filmgoers going to these theaters, which I'm still an enthusiastic, not so young filmgoer, and I've been to all these theaters a number of times and felt the energy and felt the, you know, felt the good vibes that that are emanating every time I'm there.
You have worked with Kino Lorber, which has been one of the best distributors of films that might be called art.
That's right. The company was originally called Kino International, founded in the mid-70s, run by a gentleman named Don Krem, who tragically and prematurely passed away in 2011, now very capably run by others and carrying on in that tradition of releasing both cutting-edge new foreign films and often re-releases of classics as well.
What does the loss of a venue like the Lincoln Plaza mean to a film distributor? Is getting films into art houses a specialized part of the business?
It's made it tougher to get certain films played because all of a sudden we're down six screens in that very important Upper West Side film market. Many of the films that Dan and Toby would have played at the Lincoln Plaza have managed to find homes elsewhere at the Film Society of Lincoln Center at the Landmark 57, which opened in late 2017. But there's a few that haven't played the Upper West Side. For instance, the terrific Israeli film Foxtrot that was released early last year never played on the Upper West Side in a bona fide engagement. That would have run probably 6 or 8 weeks, Toby, at the Lincoln Plaza. Right?
You know, I'd also like to say that you mentioned the potential run of a film. Dan and I, since we were independent, in other words, everything came out of our own pocket. We didn't have a large studio behind us. So we could afford to take a risk because we knew that it behooved us only, and we weren't penalizing any large entity behind us. And people who came to our theater knew that there might be a film that was a little edgy, a little non-commercial, but that there was something interesting to see. So an audience is trained and was trained to accept films that don't have, quote, commercial value.
You mentioned that you got into film distribution because you wanted to show Before the Revolution, Bertolucci's film. You developed a relationship with Bertolucci.
It was more than a relationship. We were really family. We went to his parents' house in Parma. We were very close to each. We skinny-dipped together out in Long Island. We were that friendly with him. And it was a great blow to have Bernardo die in such a short span away from Dan.
Gary, have you skinny dipped with any of the important directors whose films you've shown?
Not that I can think of, but I did have the pleasure to meet Bertolucci once at a beautiful screening of a Rossellini film in the mid-80s, and he was still trying to make a film of The Red Harvest starring Jack Nicholson as the Continental Op, and it had fallen apart, and he said, basta, no more Red Harvest. That was it. The end of that.
And that comes as a surprise because he was one of the most famous filmmakers in the world. He still had a hard time getting financing for a film project.
I think he had a fallow period in the mid-80s when two or three of his very ambitious pictures had not been successful, like 1900, which is being re-released at the Film Forum shortly, Luna with Jill Clayburgh. And there was that period where he, I think, couldn't get things going until he connected with producer Jeremy Thomas on The Last Emperor, which became very successful in the late 80s.
Are things changing now with financing of films? For example, Roma, which is a wonderful film that's an Oscar contender this year, was financed in part by Netflix.
Well, I think, I don't know if it was financed by Netflix or that Netflix came to the director Alfonso Cuarón, his partners, and offered them a lot of money for the U.S. distribution rights to the film. And it's kind of a singular case, I think, in terms of the way they've handled the film in their very ambitious quest to win the Oscar and the way it's been released in theaters atypically for Netflix.
But it's also an interesting case because it's being shown in theaters and on television at the same time. I know there was a campaign by a lot of people saying, well, you have to see it in a theater because there is something about that experience of seeing a movie in a theater. But it's still a good film if you see it on television. Is this the wave of the future?
Well, a number of people have come to our events, New Plaza Cinema, saying they didn't feel the film worked on Netflix. They kind of stopped watching it after 20 or 30 minutes, whereas people who saw it in theaters, of course, realized its beautiful craft, its gut-wrenching story. So I think I think that's still an open debate going on in the halls of New Plaza Cinemas members.
It's interesting that it's a black and white film and it feels more realistic than a color film, because we grew up on black and white films and trusted them to be the real story.
Excuse me, Leonard. Black and white is not black and white. Black and white are all the nuances of gray. I, for the 17th time yesterday, saw Pather Panchali, the Satyajit Ray movie,
yes,
in so-called black and white. There are so many textures in black and white, and it's a profound experience seeing that on a large screen. No matter how large your television screen is or your little device, it is not the same experience, and a director cannot be exhilarated at the thought of a film that he's worked on for years being shown on a 2-inch screen.
But is this going to be one of the big problems in the business? Younger people grew up with television. When I was a kid, everybody went to the movies all the time. There were so many local theaters. That's not the case anymore. It's a special event for some people today. Is the demographics in the movie business today, has it skewed rather older?
I think in many ways it has, but again, when I go to theaters like Metrograph and Quad and Nighthawk, I see a lot of enthusiastic young people there responding to seeing films on the big screen. So I think there is hopefully a core of young people that's still going to be an energizer for their peers and for future generations. I certainly took it seriously with my son, trying to bring him to see films on the screen when he was young, and I hope that continues.
There's a film theater in downtown Brooklyn where you can eat while you're watching the film.
That's the Nighthawk, but yeah. You can eat and you can watch Paths of Glory and La Dolce Vita and Two for the Road and There Will Be Blood in beautiful presentation. So I think I'll take that trade-off.
Nora said that you could have a lox sandwich at the New Plaza. What kind of food were you serving there?
You know, I'd like to have a couple of words, a sort of shop talk. Yeah. One of the things that was really glorious about the Lincoln Plaza Cinema were the people who worked there. Everyone in that staff came from a different place, and there was such a harmony in the staff that part of the experience Norma was describing was you walked into an environment where you saw a staff that were so happy to be working where they were. When Dan came there, down there, they would hug him. I, who have no sweet tooth at all, was the person who chose all the confections at the stand. So every pastry...
Didn't you run the concession stand at the New Yorker for a while?
Yes, that too, but that was not as ambitious. At the Lincoln Plaza, every pastry came from a different baker. The smoked salmon came from a Catskill smokehouse. The ham was particularly fine European ham. The cheese was particularly fine. So people knew if they could come down there after work at 5:30, they could literally have a meal there, a smoked salmon sandwich, a pastry, a cappuccino. And they knew that they would be very welcomed by the staff. So that made it for a very exceptional experience.
We're talking about keeping neighborhood movie theaters alive today on Leonard Lopate at Large. I'm talking to three people who hope that you'll go to the movies not just on Saturday night, but on any given night. Toby Talbot, who with her late husband Dan Talbot ran a number of movie theaters, and the one that we are discussing is the Lincoln Plaza Cinema, which no longer is in business, closed last year, but it led to the formation of the Coalition for New Plaza Cinema, and Norma Levy is here. She's the founder of that group, and we're also talking about just the film business in general, and we are lucky to have film distributor Gary Palmucci here. Now, Norma, when you decided that you wanted to start a group, you're a lawyer, so you probably had an advantage, but what did you do? Did you have to file to create a nonprofit?
Well, first, we had to find a group of people who were of like mind, and once we did that, we had to figure out where we were going on a sort of an ad hoc basis, day by day. Ultimately, we started out filing as a for-profit just in order to incorporate ourselves, because it's the easiest thing to do. And then after we got a little bit more experience and we had a sense of who we are and where we're going and what our likely revenue sources are going to be, we started a not-for-profit organization, and that's what we're operating as now.
And what do you do? Are you involved in showing films?
We've been showing films since late June. After we announced our formation, we managed to get in touch with the person who obtained a sent around a petition in which 10,000 people complained about the closing of Lincoln Plaza.
And that's a lot of people.
That's a lot of people.
I didn't know that many people lived in the neighborhood.
Well, some of these people, I suspect, were from all over the world. I've gotten donations from Puerto Rico and other places that you wouldn't expect us to get donations from.
Woody Allen has been a friend of the theater. I don't know whether he participated in that, but didn't he shoot a scene in the lobby? You're nodding your head, Toby.
Yes, he did.
Go ahead, Norma.
He was standing behind Marshall McLuhan when we shot that scene.
So we started right early on. We were invited by the JCC to join them in a partnership where we showed films with them at the JCC on 76th and Amsterdam. We did that for about 2 months. We had a wonderful experience there. We were able to get large crowds to see the films. Some of the films were chosen by us. Some of the films were chosen by the JCC. Then we moved over to the Symphony Space Thalia, where we also showed films for a period of time. But we had an experience at one point where thanks to Michael Moore, we were able to show a preview of his film Fahrenheit 11/9, which came out this year, a week before it opened anyplace else, and he allowed us to use that as a benefit. Mm-hmm. And the theater we ended up having that benefit for was the Institute where we're the New York Institute for Technology, which is. And it was such a wonderful experience that we've been able to show films there basically since December. We've been showing films since December 26th through today is our last day of showing films for a while.
But that's where you're going to hold this event tonight.
That is where we're going to hold our event. It's a very beautiful 259-seat theater. They've been wonderful to us, and we've been very happy being there. And we've gotten very good crowds seeing our films over the last month.
But you had a lot more seats at the Lincoln Plaza.
Well, we had six rooms.
Yeah, and they all probably had more than 250 seats.
No, No, they didn't all have more. Some had fewer.
But what is your ultimate goal, Norma? To find a permanent home on the Upper West Side?
That is our ultimate goal. We ultimately will continue operating as best we can through a mixture of ticket sales and donations, but we will be looking for investors who would like to help us start a theater, probably a nonprofit theater, someplace in the area where we're now showing films.
Why would it have to be nonprofit?
Well, it doesn't have to be nonprofit. If somebody comes along and wants to give us $20 or $30 million, we'll probably be happy to accept it. But if that doesn't happen, and it's possible it won't, we can perhaps make do with a not-for-profit organization that's supported by the community. We've had we have a benefit that's going on tonight where the community has been unbelievable in its support. People, some people paying $30 for a ticket, but many people paying $100, $250, you know, and more for tickets for a movie theater because they believe in what they're doing and they want to support us.
And so do filmmakers. You have had the support of a number of filmmakers, Betty West and Jill Cohn, for example.
Yes.
You showed RBG their film?
We did.
Did you premiere it?
No, we didn't premiere it. It had already played. But they came and did a Q&A at our theater, which was excellent. It was very well received.
As part of their Oscar campaign, the distributor dispatched them to the theater to do a Q&A afterwards, and it was a terrific experience because these ladies were just walking on air with the acclaim that RBG has received, and to be in yet another Full House doing a Q&A. We had Paul Schrader at the theater also campaigning on behalf of First Reformed, and so both these filmmakers were successful. They're both Oscar nominated, and that was really a gas for us.
If New Plaza Cinema is successful, Toby, would you want to go back into the business?
Of course.
But are you participating in this project right now?
I'm participating in certainly encouraging every effort and lending myself to every effort to help these people. And Gary is more prominently involved in the programming with my support and approval.
Now, Gary, we mentioned earlier that some of the directors that that New Yorker Films was distributing are among the most important in film history, and there were some more. Well, Godard, Simbeni, Straub, Huillier, Bresson, Inamura. Would any of them have made it as Americans to American screens if they hadn't been brought over by New Yorker Films?
Well, I think in perhaps in different ways, or in ways it would have taken them more longer to come to the attention of the general art house public. But I think the fact that Dan famously bought 12 Fassbinders and probably six or eight Herzogs, Toby, and supported African filmmakers like Simbeni and Mbete and very difficult, challenging filmmakers like Straub and Huillier.
And then showed films like Bresson's L'Argent, a film that never would have been shown otherwise.
Well, L'Argent was released by an enterprising company called Cinecom, the principals of whom are still in the film business, but Dan played it at the Lincoln Plaza very, very successfully, positioned it in a way that it would not have been otherwise successful.
And Gary, I think it's possible that a film... Usman Senben, we distributed his very first efforts, and he subsequently became known as the father of African cinema. I'm not so certain whether his path would have been easy to find international acclaim if we hadn't consistently played and distributed his films.
And as great as he was, one of my great thrills is that I interviewed him years ago.
When we first met him, he was in his early 20s with his African garb and his typical pipe. And again, he became part of our family, in fact. And this would have been so for some of the Latin American filmmakers, as well as the Asian filmmakers that you've mentioned. Some ultimately would have found their correct spot in film history. Others not.
You've said that at Lincoln Plaza, you would play a film that you knew had... no commercial value, or would have been assumed to have had no commercial value. But since you had admired and respected it, you wanted to share it with your audience. And did some of them turn out to have commercial value after all? Is it a matter of how you present something?
Certainly, the early efforts of Senben would have been considered small films, and ultimately he got on every African black film list in the country. He became part of the curriculum. Yeah. Maybe Straub Huillier remained rather esoteric, but this team, father and husband and wife, were highly admired by other filmmakers, even though he was very rigorous in his filmmaking. Bertolucci, for example. So they were authors' authors, and at least our cinema community was introduced to people who were trying to do something radically different.
At the same time, you're also dealing with commercial filmmakers. How did you become involved with Woody Allen?
Well, he became involved with us. Hmm. He came to the New Yorker Theater and to all of our other movie houses. And when Woody finished a film, we were the first people that he asked to come to his studio to look at it.
Didn't one of the films that you were involved with, Point of Order, a documentary that you made with Emile D'Antonio, lead to some threatened lawsuits?
Yes, it got Dan on the enemy list.
Because
Point
Roy
of Order
Cohn
was... Point of, yes, Roy Cohn first threatened him with a suit. And because of the Army McCarthy issue being so sensitive, Dan made this film with Emile D'Antonio, and it got him on the enemies list. Dan didn't worry about that very much.
Well, Emile D'Antonio took full credit for the film, so...
Which was not quite accurate.
Yeah, but I wonder whether Roger Stone would have been suing. He was... Roy Cohn was Roger Stone's mentor, also Donald mm-hmm. Trump's mentor. Mm-hmm. But it never went to court?
Never, no.
So were there any others where you had problems along that kind of line?
No, no. Dan's typical contract was on a little slip of paper, such as you might go to a laundry, you know, 4x2 piece of paper. Mm-hmm. That was his contract.
He died, as we said, this year, along with Bertolucci. And then just last week, Jonas Mekas passed away. That is the older generation. Gary, how important was someone like Jonas Mekas?
Well, I remember first...
even though he was a rather thorny character. He
could be, although that wasn't my experience. But I remember first meeting him in 1982. I went to a screening of what was the last night of the Anthology Film Archives and its incarnation on Worcester Street, to see a film, The Chelsea Girls by Andy Warhol, the first film that I'd ever seen by Mr. Warhol. And Mekas was there introducing the film and sort of bemoaning the closing of Anthology in that venue. And then it took him 6 years to establish Anthology at the old courthouse at 2nd Avenue and 2nd Street, where it has thrived since then. I understand in 2017 they had their best year there for attendance ever. So I think that... to me, that's a remarkable story. I'm a little too young to have experienced it in the 50s and 60s when he first became important on the scene here, but I admire tremendously what he did and what his core of young people has done down there at that theater that are going to carry it on.
Well, he is that anomaly, a filmmaker who wound up being a film distributor and also someone who showed films.
Correct. A few have tried it, but usually only in a one-off situation.
As in your case, were you ever tempted, Toby, to make another film?
I was not only tempted, but I did.
Uh-huh. Well, you've written a number of books. We'll get to that, too. But
yes,
what are the other films?
A very modest film called Berimbau. Berimbau is purported to be the oldest musical instrument in civilization. It looks essentially like a large hunting bow, and it's played with a little wand and a gourd. And this is a modest documentary about the evolution of music.
I've mentioned your memoir, which has, by the way, a foreword by Martin Scorsese, who thanks you and Dan for being there for him when he was trying to learn about movies. It's called The New Yorker Theater and Other... what is it? And,
scenes.
And other scenes from a life at the movies. But you've written a number of books, including a novel?
Well, I have written a number of books. I've written a dozen or so children's books. Mm-hmm. I've done a dozen or so translations from the Spanish. And I've written a memoir about my mother called A Book About My Mother. Mm-hmm. And I've written a pseudonymous novel. And I am currently working on another memoir. And am more importantly working on a book now of Dan's writings.
Interestingly, in the memoir that we've been talking about, The New Yorker Theater, You include program notes written by literary figures such as Jack Kerouac from movies that you screened in your theaters over the years. You saved all of them, obviously.
Yes, we have all the guest books. Dan gave his archive to Columbia University Press, Uptown, and Columbia University Press is the one who did my memoir on the New Yorker Theater. But his archives are intact.
I wondered about the Upper West Side being, well, where Columbia is located. There are a number of other major schools located there. Why do you think it's been such a struggle? I mean, wouldn't college kids be coming to the theaters all the time, supporting these theaters?
Well, they certainly came to the New Yorker.
Which was just down the block.
Yes, but no, many of them came to the Lincoln Plaza Cinema. I think that, first of all, people came from the East Side to the Lincoln Plaza Cinema. New Yorkers are very eager not only to walk, but to get on crosstown buses and so forth.
Well, I used to get on the subway and go from Brooklyn.
Yes.
Okay, so what is the current situation, Norma? Is it likely there are no available theaters in the area? Would somebody have to build a theater to duplicate what we are missing?
Well, we would be. There is available theater. There's the Lincoln Plaza Theater, which we would love to have.
Well, what's happened? Have you spoken to the Millstones?
Very early on, I had a discussion with the attorney, and he made it pretty clear that you have to have very deep pockets. we're not in a position at this point to really finance that. But there is a theater available if we could get the funding for it, and we would love to do that because
you'd have to refurbish it.
That would be a pleasure to do. And we are looking at what alternatives are in terms of space. We're now at the New York Institute. There are other alternatives that we're thinking of that we're looking into. And we will try and raise money, and if we have to, we'll build a theater someplace else, you know, if we're able to raise the money for it.
Gary, getting back to something I addressed a little bit earlier, film historian Max Alvarez says the major challenge in the future will be to get new generations to discover the excitement and the cultural importance of seeing a film in the cinema, because without the younger people, the cinema is going to die off.
Well, Max is an old friend of mine, and I agree with him 100%. I think I mentioned that I certainly took it as a personal mission to bring my son to the movies a lot. He saw Lawrence of Arabia on the big screen when he was 9 years old, and you know, some of those other big epics, and some of the great westerns by Ford and Hawks and so forth. And it's a mission. I think it's up to every individual who's a movie lover here in New York to carry it on somehow with their family, with their friends, with whoever they can.
Will Netflix and Amazon and the other cable movie channels be able to fill the void?
I think Netflix, from what I can see, has very little in the way of older films now on its channel. I'm not so sure about Amazon. I would say these.
I know I go through the list and I don't want to see the few good ones. I've already seen, unfortunately.
I think someone told me recently that the oldest film they could find on Netflix was To Kill a Mockingbird. That's 1962. And that's kind of a scary thought. But I would consider these services supplementary to young people's knowledge and inculcation. But the theater experience is still primary, and we're lucky here that we can still. This is kind of a golden age, really, for specialized theaters, the ones I've just mentioned. And some young people take advantage.
So, Norman, the little time that we have left, can you tell us about what's planned for tonight?
Tonight we have a benefit. It's a tribute to Lincoln Plaza and to Dan Talbot and to Bernardo Bertolucci. We will be playing The Conformist, which is one of the great works of Bertolucci.
Did you distribute The Conformist as well? No. Then Bertolucci had, you'd made Bertolucci big enough so the other people wanted him.
It was released by Paramount Pictures originally in the U.S., and they held the rights for about 40 years or so until they expired. It's now handled by my former employer, Kina Lorber.
Well, but are people showing films like that anymore?
I think some of these theaters I mentioned to you are still very much committed to, you know, regular programs of classics, you know, thematically and individually.
So you're going to be showing The Conformist, and then that's at 6:30.
The 6:30, we're having a pre-event where some of the people who've paid a fair amount of money to go see this sponsor us are going to be have the pleasure of hearing Toby speak. And then after the film, we'll be having a wine and dessert function for everybody in the theater. It's totally sold out. There are no tickets.
Oh, so we and people who are listening are saying, "Gee, I really want to go to this."
Well, but after the film, Philip Lopate and myself will have a Q&A. The film ends approximately at 8:30, and then there'll be a Q&A with Philip and myself.
Well, since it's sold out, why don't you just do a second one?
That's a good idea. Thank you. Maybe we will.
There are other Bertolucci films available.
Maybe we will.
Before the Revolution was a pretty good film.
All right.
Do you still own distribution rights to that one, Toby? No.
No, it's not. It's not in release in the United States right now, unfortunately. Not even on DVD. I'm not sure what the reasons for that are, but it's an odd and puzzling omission.
So if I just released a DVD, would I be breaking the law? Has it entered into public domain?
I would say probably not. It's probably protected by something called the GATT Treaty, where foreign films, even if they weren't promptly copyrighted, can be retroactively copyrighted by their owners in the United States, and many people have taken advantage of that.
So, Norma, this event is a success. Do you have any other ones planned for the near future?
We're going to take some time to plan our future. We're going to continue to talk to the New York Institute. We're also looking elsewhere for opportunities that may be available for us. We will be focusing on fundraising. I'd like to, anybody who would like to support us, we're the New Plaza Cinema. We just like them to make a check out to us. It could be a tax deductible contribution if they make it payable to our fiscal sponsor, who is Women Make Movies. If they make it to us, it will not be tax deductible at this point,
can say when they send it to Women Make Movies, I want this to go
to the benefit of New Plaza Cinema. And, you know, we're hoping that ultimately and in the short term, we'll raise a fair amount of money and we'll be able to find a space for us that's a permanent space.
Well, good luck with it. And my great thanks to the three of you for being on our show. Norma Levy, the founder of the Coalition for a New Plaza Cinema, film distributor Gary Palmucci, and Toby Talbot, who is the person responsible for all of this. It's been a real pleasure having you all here.
Thank you for inviting us.
Thank you.
Terrific. Thank you.
And that brings us to the end of today's show. My great thanks to Toby Talbot, Norma Levy, and Gary Palmucci, to Charlie Morrow, who composed our theme music, to my producer, Jesse Lent, who is at the audio controls today. Leonard Lopate at Large comes to you on Saturdays at 4 and Tuesdays at noon. You can subscribe to the Leonard Lopate at Large podcast on iTunes and by clicking on Robin Hood Radio's archive program site, which is robinhoodradio.com. You can also check out Leonard Lopate at Large Facebook page. We hope to see you next week.